Okay, I'm just going to start. It doesn't matter when you start. Okay, the second lecture about dating and marriage. There's a session, Rabbi Dr. Markson. And whenever he starts, he'll start. There might be a 3-minute gap now, a la Richard Nixon.
That was 18 minutes.
Thanks. Okay. Hi, thanks for all. Thanks everyone for coming. My son tells me, hold on here. Okay. I'd like to begin tonight by giving you one of the most traumatic events of my youth. I remember it as if it were yesterday. It was the day Mrs. Bogart's 6th grade class took a day trip to Manhattan to see Peter Pan. The costumes were great. The music was even better, but there was something very, very scary. Most of the class agreed that Captain Hook was the scariest guy in the whole play. This hook, and he walked around, and he scared all the kids. It's a lot of fun. To me, Peter Pan, I'll explain why Peter Pan was scary. I thought to myself, whose idea was this to expose me and my fellow young men of the 6th grade to this overwhelming, complex, Jungian, archetypal passion play, whose main character, Peter Pan, was this amalgam of everything wrong with men in the Western world. And add to irony of ironies, what I see today as a therapist is much like what I saw on that fateful day in New York City, namely the tragedy of the man-boy or the man-child. Peter Pan was magical. He did not want to grow up. Why would he? Who'd want to grow up into an adult if adulthood is represented by the likes of Captain Hook? Talk about scary. Peter Pan wanted his innocence, but gets chased around by this crocodile with a clock in its stomach. So to eat you one way or another. So he thinks he can just live in Neverland forever, avoiding Wendy, a grounded, likable enough girl who accepts the world as it is. But Peter Pan isn't ready to settle down with Wendy. Instead, he goes for Tinkerbell, who doesn't even exist. It's a fantasy, i.e. the internet. The story goes on. 18, so many young men that I sit with, they want to get married, in theory. They get involved, yet they hesitate. They want to go forward, but they falter. They double back, they triple check, all with good intention, but all lacking a certain courage and conviction to move forward. They move a little bit, take a step back. Some get married, some don't. Marriage solves little for them. Are they our modern day Peter Pans, I wonder? They are what Jordan Peterson calls the tragedy of the man boy. Too psychologically young to get married and too old not to try. What they lack is a fundamental understanding and acceptance of the fact that there is a sacrificial element in the maturation process. We cannot and should not ever try to remain Peter Pan. I'll tell you a story about a young man who married a woman and found out about the first 6 months of marriage that she is suffering from a trauma of her past. Unfortunately, not that uncommon today. They went to doctors, rabbis, and therapists, and I met with him individually, and he asked me what he could reasonably expect. On the face of it, it's a reasonable question. But as he probed more, it grew more and more apparent that he was searching less for a treatment protocol and more for an exit. On this case, I was actually a consultant, and the supervisee of mine was the therapist. Here's a bit of the dialogue between me and the therapist. Me. How's it going with the couple, therapist? Seems to be making progress, actually, in a twisted way, she said. Well, I said, one thing they have going for them is that they're almost all they've got. They're all alone. Therapist, yep. And they know it. They are lone people struggling to be married. I said to her, actually, I think of it as two married people struggling to be alone. She said, that's quite confusing. I said, yeah, I know. And I told her about a trauma case that I was working on. And that day, I was doing EMDR, which is a trauma treatment protocol. And it was going well. And this young man was suffering from a traumatic experience. And the picture that he had in mind was fading from his consciousness, which is a good thing. So it was going along. And then he said something interesting. He said, in a sort of a shaky voice, why are you trying to take away the trauma from me? And I told the story to my supervisee, and she said, yes, exactly. That's this couple. That's exactly what's happening. As soon as they move forward, they accuse you of trying to take away their trauma. And then they kick back. So this ebb and flow, this dance that keeps on going and going and going, seemingly forever. So I told her, people get very possessive about their dysfunction. It's kind of a glue. She said, that was exactly my conversation with the wife this morning. The movement from being alone, thinking alone, to truly incorporating your spouse into your thinking is called relationship. This movement is the essential building block of personal growth, the crucible by which we hone ourselves, and thus the Evan Yesod on which true spiritual madrigas are attained. The pace of this movement is often slow and arduous. So before you get too bummed out by this, I'll tell you a story. It actually happened to me, and it happened to a friend of, not to me, but a friend of mine after high school. So his name is Gary, and I don't know where he is today. It happened a long time ago. But after high school, Gary, it was in the late 60s, and Gary went to India to find himself. And he traveled all around, and he, like many young Jewish young men, he found himself with a guru. And he stayed there for 2 years, and this guru became his guru. And he was sitting at the guru's feet, and he was becoming a disciple. And after about 2 years, he wanted to become a monk. So the guru told him, if you want to become a monk, what you have to do is you have to go back home and visit your parents and tell them for the last time that you're going to be seeing them. Because in order to become a monk, as a disciple of mine, you have to give up attachment to all things, family, friends, any attachment to anything in this world. So you have to tell them that, he said. So off Gary went down the hill, down the mountain, to the plane, back to India, back to New York, where I picked him up at JFK, and I was driving him back to Middletown, New York, where we grew up. So his parents were waiting for him, and Gary walked in. His parents greeted him, and Gary had lost a lot of weight. He was tall and thin to begin with. Sat down at the kitchen table, the table where so many arguments and fighting had taken place between him and his parents. His mother said, you want something to eat? Gary said, no, Ma, no thanks. What? She said, you don't want something to eat? No, Ma, thanks, I'm okay. You look skinny, she says. Saul, she says, doesn't he look skinny? You're too skinny, she finally blurted out. I'm okay, Ma. But he started to get a little anxious, and he raised his voice. Don't talk to your mother like that, the father chimed in. You think she hasn't been suffering since you've been gone? All I said was Gary got confused. Here comes the back talk, Saul said. Big shot. Mr. Monk loved the whole world except his parents, is about to say something. Enough, Gary shouted. Klop on the bima. And ran to his bedroom. He sat on the edge of the bed. We had sat many years waiting for someone or something to come walking in the door and help him. But no one came. He began to cry. He was so out of control, he did the only thing he knew, which was to go to his parents' bedroom and start making calls frantically to try somehow to get a hold of the guru. Now, it was the 1960s, and I don't know how many people can relate to this, but there were no cell phones. where in the 1960s, and there's only this phone, this dial phone, and he was trying to get to the village, but you couldn't get to the village. So you could get to a nearby village, and you get to a messenger who got the translator. You see what's happening here. It was very, very convoluted way of getting in touch with somebody. He finally got through, and he got a message to the guru. And here's what Gary said. He said, "Tell the guru, I can't believe it. 2 years of my life, peace and quiet, and it shattered in 10 minutes. How can that be? 2 years, 10 minutes? The messenger went to deliver the message. Soon he would come back with an answer from the guru. The call came back in. Gary picked up the phone. The messenger said to him, "You say 2 years, 10 minutes. Guru say, 2 years, 10 minutes. Not bad." Not bad. 2 years, 10 minutes, not bad. We see and are seen as finished products, and we don't fully respect and appreciate the journey that we are on and the different journey our spouse is on as well. The lesson we learn is always eat what your mother puts in front of you. Always eat what your mother puts in front of you. Next rule that we had. There's only one reasonable assumption to make in understanding your spouse: that the interpretations you are running with about him or her are probably wrong or incomplete. One thing I like to do in session after someone says, "This is what I think she means," I say, "Well, hold on. She happens to be right here. Let's ask." And inevitably, some part of what he says will be right, but there will always be a part of it that he doesn't get, and he'll have to be completed. On this idea of don't assume you know you're always right, I want to tell you a story. And it's a story about our son, who at the time was 3 or 4, and he came home from Ghana. We were living in Muncie, and he came home from something called Uzgan or something like that. And he was a very energetic, very, very alive young man. Still is today. But he came home and he said, "Mommy, I'm going to lie down on the couch." And there he stayed for a very long time, days and maybe even a week. And a parent should never know from such a thing. It was very, very scary, and we didn't know what it was. And we took it to doctors and blood tests and this and that and alternative and mainstream. You know, we did everything, and still he wasn't responding. So as it happened, a friend of ours told us about somebody up in Buffalo. We lived in Muncie. Buffalo is about 8 hours away, 8.5 hours away. So he told us about a person. She was a devout Christian, and most of her clientele was from Hasidim from Williamsburg. And once we found that out, we figured, okay, she's okay. And we drove up there. We took the middle seat out of the van, and we put a bed there. And he stayed there, and he had a lot of fun. We were playing, and we went up to Buffalo. We saw Niagara Falls, and finally we came to her office, and sure enough, there's Getchkas everywhere and pictures of you-know-who and Hasidim, and they had mechitza there. It was a pretty wild affair. And finally, our time came to come in, and she was a very professional woman, and she said, "What's wrong with him?" And she had him. He was facing her, and she had his head in her hands. She was holding on to him, and she was looking in his eyes. She was a iridologist. She was looking into his eyes. And I was saying, "We don't know what's wrong with him. He's weak. He's weak." And she was looking in his eyes, and she's going, she said, "Name." She's talking Yiddish, right? You know, she's going, "No, he's not weak." And I'm saying, "But he doesn't get off the, he can't, he's not strong enough to get his head off the couch. He's weak. What's going to be?" She's going, "No." And she looked at me, and when she looks at your, she looked at me, she said, "If he wasn't as strong as he is, he wouldn't be even here today." So that was a very meaningful and very profound lesson about what you think you know and what's really going on. Sometimes it seems from the outside that people are a certain way. Until we know the inner workings, we essentially know nothing. That's one of my premises for work. P.S. to this story, this young man, this bocher, is not only keeping 3 siddharim a day, but he rides between 50 and 100 kilometers on his bike between siddharim in the middle of the heat, in the middle of the afternoon. So she was very, very right. Next rule. You always marry what you wanted in the first place. George Bernard Shaw said, there's only one thing worse than not getting what you want, and that's getting what you want. What did he mean? That's because we do not want to pay the price for the thing we want. I remember when my sister moved into her apartment building in the Upper East Side in New York City, and it was a doorman building. And she was very happy. She wanted a doorman building. It was a time in New York where there's a lot of crime, and she was happy to have the doorman there. And it was in the middle of the summertime. And then came the holiday season, and she found out the price of what it cost to have a doorman building. And she was shocked. To which I said to her at the time, Debbie, if you want to live in a doorman building, you got to pay the doorman. And that's what it is in relationship. We get the thing we want, but we don't want to pay the price of the package that comes along with it, because we want everything. So the problem is we get what we want, but we don't want to pay for the package, and that's a problem with reality. It's not a problem with our spouse. Next rule. There's nothing more wholesome in the whole world than a broken Jewish heart. That I hope that translation is true to the Kutzker Rebbe. There's many different types of, seen it in many different forms. I think this is, I don't know, exact translation, but perhaps it's at least accurate. I've spent literally over 20 years rolling this Kutzker around in my mind. At first, I was totally perplexed by it. Understanding the Kutzker has never been an easy task. But this cryptic statement seems almost unintelligible. How can a broken heart be a good thing, a wholesome thing? Perhaps pshat goes something like this. Something is healthy when it's functioning well. And things function well when it conforms to a certain system. Think the human body. The system is teva, and teva operates with a certain predictability and inevitability. If we train the body, we can predict a higher level of fitness. If we ignore the body, we can predict a certain inevitability as well. So too with relationship. Relationship also conforms to a system. As the Kutzker, and the Kutzker is saying, that part of the health of the system of relationship is a broken heart. There is no such thing as a relationship of any meaning or import that does not have within it the experience of getting your heart broken. One cannot reasonably speak of wanting intimacy or relationship without understanding this as a logical unfolding of the human spirit. The Kutzker is warning us of its inevitability. Therefore, it's incumbent upon us not to be unduly shocked or dismayed when it happens. It is, whether we know it or not at the time, what we signed up for. Next rule. Marriage is like a motorcycle. In college, the cheapest and best mode of transportation was the motorcycle, at least for me. And I partook of this mode with vim and vigor. Kawasaki was my middle name. One day I was going to campus and a neighbor saw me don my helmet and prepared to take off. She had a handful of books and was obviously going up to campus as well. I asked her if she wanted a ride. It seemed like the gentlemanly thing to do. No, she said, and she looked at me incredulously. She just stood there looking at me and at the large black menacing machine that stood before her. Okay, suit yourself, and off I went. Years later, I'm sitting with a guy who rides a motorcycle, and he's talking about how difficult it is for him to get married. So I tell him, you know, marriage is like a motorcycle. I tell him about the questioning on the girl's face a long time ago. And I tell him, only now, maybe 40 years later, do I understand what she was looking at when she was looking at the motorcycle and she was standing there. And it was a long road. If you've ever been to Ithaca, it's just hills everywhere. And she was actually choosing to walk up these hills with a load of books instead of getting an easy ride up the hill. What was she thinking? Can he drive? Is there enough gas to get us there? Does he have enough money to keep this bike going? This is the rule. Guys like life because it's fun. Get on the bike and let's go. Simple. Girls stand there with a lot of questions before they're ready to get back on your bike and sail away up the campus with you and into the sunset perhaps as well. So these are some of the rules. Finally, I don't know which rule this is, rule 6, 7. This rule is called never give up. You're not going to believe this, but in the course of these past 2 weeks, as I've sat and prepared, and especially prepared this talk this evening about some of the rules, some of the clothing, let's say, that I wanted to give over, I kind of got stuck. I got stuck on the rule beforehand, and I thought, you know, there should be more to say. I should have more to give over. So I didn't know what. I thought I'd given over everything, but and then the phone started ringing. And one person, I don't know how many, I lost track of the calls, but people that I hadn't worked with in a long time, maybe 5, 7, 8 years, they had called up for something else. They wanted a letter, they wanted to invite me to a simcha, or whatever it was. But, and they said, before I could even ask, they said, yeah, we're still married, we're still going, you know, we're still going along. And I thought about that. I didn't say anything, and I remember thinking at the time I was working with them, these couples would not necessarily be voted most likely to succeed, you know, but they had succeeded. And I was curious as to what had happened all along, but we didn't have hours and hours to bring it up to date. But basically, the people who called, they said sort of one klal gadol, which was, we just kept on sort of going along and moving forward and having to go through therapists or go through rabbis. We just kept on moving along and trying to work it out and trying to go forward. And I'm not saying, of course I'm not saying that there are times where divorce is necessary and all that, because I even got in that time period, over these past 2 weeks, maybe it's the 3 weeks, maybe it's the inevitability of Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur around the corner, but I got calls from divorcees as well saying, you know, it was a good thing, it was something, I've moved forward, I'm engaged, I want to tell you about it, etc., etc. So all this is happening at the time I'm preparing, you know, these lectures. So they all reported the idea of holding on, moving forward, holding on, moving forward, as a concept that held them out all the way. So it made me think, it was a very humbling thing for me. And maybe this is one of the threads that run through all these stories and all these rules. That's very humbling, working with people in general, and this topic in specific. You know, there are very few people who are as privy to as much knowledge as or inner knowledge as a therapist is. Perhaps you could say they know more about the spouse than the spouses themselves. And yet, for how much we're on the face of it supposed to know, or we do know, there is obviously a tremendous amount that we don't know, and that's a mystery, and that's what keeps us going, I think, from case to case and year to year. that we don't assume we know, and we're curious instead of judgmental, and we seek to understand, and we seek to try to bring people to something called clarity of soul. There's a fellow that I like to listen to on YouTube, Jordan Peterson, who's a psychologist in Canada, and he talks about therapists as the engineers of the soul. So that's an interesting muscle, because before I became a therapist, I was an engineer, and for a few years, and until life took me in a different direction. But when he said it, it seemed very, very apropos, because engineers are not scientists. Scientists wonder about why. They try to figure out why things happen. Engineers try to fix things. My father, Olav Sholem, was a truck mechanic, and he was very good at fixing things. And I worked in his shop for many years. And he had a lot of, he came out of World War II with a lot of very strong sense of work ethic, and a strong sense of never give up until you've actually learned something from what you've done. So this kind of work ethic has, I guess, informed me in my practice. And the more you get involved with people in these type of cases, the more you learn and the more you get humble. And like last time, I think I spoke longer last time, but I'm happy to take questions about anything that was presented here today, or anything in general. We had a lot of very good questions last week. So anything, feel free to ask. Yes, sir. Rabbi Griever.
How do you understand what the Chassid Rebbe is saying? That in every relationship, one of the parties had to have been hurt in order for it to be a healthy relationship. Or that the person coming in had an experience once in his lifetime with a broken heart.
That's the community, you know. I think what the Kutzker is saying is that romantic thinking stops at the broken heart. Hollywood tells us once you fall out of love, you're done. I think the Kutzker was saying that's when you get started. That? Yes.
How do you deal with a man boy?
Peter Pan?
Yeah.
Well, so in college, I was kind of a music major somewhere along the line there too. And the only thing I remember from the musicology courses was this phrase called leitmotif. You know what a leitmotif is? It's a little flute music, in this case, Peter, it's a little ditty that they play that is the theme that introduces the character on the, right? So I remember from this Peter Pan, it's not a made-up story, we actually did go to Peter Pan. And whenever Peter Pan, before he would appear, there'd be this very high, fluty music. And Peter Pan would kind of prance in. And the question is, how do you deal with someone like that? It's a good question. The answer is slowly, gently, and very assuredly. What the man boy is lacking usually is a father, an authority figure. And he spends his psychological life looking for one, either overtly or covertly. So you can't take the place of that father, but you can be a mentor, and you can bring him along if he accepts your authority. And it's a very it's a very precarious position for a therapist not to go overboard, not to start telling him what to do, and not to take too much authority. It's a long, slow, arduous process. 2 years, 10 minutes is it's an exaggeration, but it's kind of like that. It's one step forward, one step back, but this is one of the, I think, hallmarks of this generation that I see, is the soft male trying to come into a world where his sensitivity and his intelligence are tremendous milas, but he needs the strength to go out there and either keep in the base medrash. You know, a Rebbe of mine in yeshiva was a Talmud of Rav Ovadia Zatzal, and a question came to him once, what do we do with, do we teach gaiva? Do we teach about, you know, anava to a bacher in yeshiva? And he said in the name of Volbi that he said, don't teach a bacher anava until he's in his mid-20s or so, because until he needs all the gaiva that he has in order to get through the system. The system is that hard. So I'm not equating anava with weakness, obviously, but there's a certain strength that men need to sort of take ownership of as also part of the rightful passage, not just the softness, not just the Peter Pan. Unfortunately, what was devastating about the storyline of that play is those are the only two options, and those are horrible two options. The Torah man is the middle way, and Darchecha Darchei Noam, and I think that's the answer to the storyline of Peter Pan. Yes, ma'am.
What do you define the Peter Pan man boy? Someone doesn't want to grow up.
Yes, he does. He's in fantasy. He chooses against Wendy and wants to stay with Tinkerbell, and Tinkerbell doesn't exist. His mind is going, his body is going through the motions of wanting to get married and wanting to grow up, but in his mind he's sequestered, he's alone, he's psychologically. Please speak up.
I'm wondering about that theory that you said that he's lacking an authoritarian father figure. Is that just a theory, or is
it? No, this question was about what do you do with the soft. His question is what do you do with this the no, it's similar, and I'm saying it usually comes from a lack of that, but I'm not psychoanalyzing Peter Pan. I'm using it as sort of a metaphor for what I see this generation facing, at least as far as men are concerned, young men coming into manhood. That in literature is called something. This is not our generation. This is, for the, you know, you look in Chumash, Moshe Rabbeinu came into manhood after he had to leave the palace. That's true, and that's an archetype. That's a story. That's the hero's journey. In German, Yiddish, it's called Bildungsroman. And that's the story, that's a genre in literature. Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha, and is the story of young men coming into manhood. So, how they grow up, and this is the story of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is the story of Chumash as well.
What's the quote again from Bernard Shaw about...
That there's only one thing worse than not getting what you want, and that's getting what you want. And that idea is, people will come to me after a certain number, you know, 6 months, a year, 20 years. I didn't get what I wanted. You know, I didn't. And the answer is, you did get what you wanted. You also got a package that came along with what you wanted, and you're wrapping what you wanted. You've forgotten what you really did, but if you remind them back, what did you see? What were you looking for? You'll find out. You'll find out. They have answers. It's not a mystery. She had grace. She had beauty. She was a Talmida Chachama. She was into personal growth. You'll find a Nekuda that they really were very taken with, and they married it. Actually, they married a person, but they married a thing. They just didn't marry a person. They didn't marry Miss Personality. They married something about them that was very, very deeply resonant to them. It's just inevitably when they grow up together and they experience all of each other, then he says, oh, wow, just, you know, wow, it's really a plus-minus situation here. And then, as we know, the negative starts to take over. And maybe I've said it before, but when I was growing up, there was a book, a big red cover, that said The Power of Positive Thinking, you know, and nothing could be, I think, technically wrong. If you want raw power of the human mind, it's in the negative. And we adhere to the negative, that's where the power is. We have to work hard, and this is what Chazal is all about, this is what Musar movement is all about, Slobodka and Navarna, to overtake the negative, because the negative is actually the default position. We don't have books, we don't have a swarm on the shelf that say how to think negatively. It's a good line for a book. We don't have okay. Yes.
That's what you were just saying. So
okay.
When you say that the person got what they wanted,
yes.
You're talking about the disappointment and understanding that this person has flaws also. And
yes.
Then, so how do you deal with the couple that's discovering each other's flaws and just the disappointment that they're going through?
Sometimes you cry with them. Sometimes you mourn with them. Sometimes you slap him upside the head. Everybody's different. Sometimes you do all three. You have to find a way of starting where they're at. I know it's cliche and classic, but that is the answer. Something that they can relate to. And then you help them find something inside them that's deeper than their dilemma. Their dilemma is describing something, more often than not, something shitchi, something on the surface, not superficial, but on the surface. And the reasons why they're in it are usually much deeper. And if you invite them to go to a deeper place, and they go there, then you can invite them to stay there. And if they stay there, you can invite them to live there. And once you they've taken up your invitations, then you've created a different person. Because then they live in the depth of, not to be dramatic, but the depth of humanity. They're living with flaw. They are flawed. And that's the default position of their relationship. That's the starting gate. Sometimes I gave a talk a while ago, and I called it radical acceptance. Why is it radical? Because it flies in the face of what you're looking at. On the face of it, you're looking at something illogical. You're looking at something that says, I can't deal with this. You're looking at something that's crossed a line. You're looking at something that you know, 100 people in a room, if presented with the facts of what's driving you crazy, would all agree, yes, there's a sugar, yes. And yet, what's being asked of you is, you know, in Hebrew, it's afal pi kein. Nevertheless, even so, you have to, I'm fond of saying to guys, especially guys in Beis Medrash, that there's a phrase in Gemara called Mimonashach. And Mimonashach is loosely translated as either way, you're caught between a rock and a hard place. It's usually in an argument in the Gemara. And Mimonashach means if you go like this way of thinking, there's a problem. If you go like this way of thinking, there's a problem. You're stuck. So what do? Is the Rav here? Rav's not here. I have to ask him. Because I said this, and I want to ask the Rav if it's actually true, you would know. I say that there's not one instance in Shas where you have a B'manashach where you don't have an La'olam. La'olam is really, it goes like this. I don't know if women are following, but here it goes. If we go like A, there's a problem with A. If we go like B, there's a problem with B. La'olam, really, we're going with A. What do you mean? You just told me there's a big problem with A. The answer is, I know there's a problem, but I can't stay with the problem. That'd be gridlock, and we can't operate in the world of Gemara. We can't operate like that. We have to have something to say. So it's better to try to solve the problem. It's better to try to say something with the problem than not say anything at all. That is a very long-winded answer to a short question, but I think, yeah, okay. I think we're going to equal and opposite. Yeah, Sina. Speak up.
But when you have a couple that, okay, small issue, suddenly triggers them, and every time a little debate becomes a huge big fight.
Yes.
And what hurts is the fact that it's not the problem, it's the whole hurt in the relationship. How do you work that out? Because it's something small, and suddenly the pain becomes so huge.
Yeah. excuse me. To them I say, being a therapist is very easy. You say something small, I see something big. You say something limited, I see something expansive. What do I mean? They're lost in the pratim of their lives, the details. And you don't have to be young to be lost in the details. You could be 20, you could be 40, you could be 70. And those are the arguments, right? This is essentially, no matter what the chronological age is, but it's essentially an adolescent marriage. Meaning, if I told you, and you didn't know the couple, there are two people who are fighting. I wanted the last piece of pizza. No, I wanted the last piece of pizza. I cleaned up the dishes yesterday. No, I cleaned them up yesterday. I put them in the sink. I took them out of the sink. I put them on the counter. I put them on the counter. On and on and on. What age would you tell? What age would you say that is?
10.
2? 2? They can't reach the counter.
Exaggeration for effect.
Exaggeration for effect. Thank you. Good. 10? Yeah. Not above 12, right? That's what you're looking at psychologically. So you have to go. You have to expose that, and you have to see if there's something more maturity there than that. Meaning, what you're asking them to do is what the book that I grew up with is "Don't Sweat the Small Stuff." I don't know if I like that title, but it's the idea of prat and klal. Maturity means in this sense, you know, making a decision for something bigger than this shakala vitaria, which is just a formula for misery. It's about parenting. It's about reparenting them, actually. They're redoing a fight that they did. They walked out of their biological house and they walked into this marriage. But essentially, they're at their Shabbos table fighting with their brothers and sisters. And does that sound harsh? Okay, so it's more reality than you would think. The chuppah is a magical place, but it's not complete magic, you know. And that's what happens a lot of times. They're like brother sister type of things. I saw your hand, but we're going to go. Yes, ma'am.
How much of accepting another person's flaws,
yes,
applies to dating as opposed to aftermath?
Speak more. Tell me more. That's interesting. Applies to dating. It doesn't. Dating is a different deal. You're allowed to make real selfish decisions. The process of dating, it depends when in the dating. I mean, I would say up until the first X number of dates, I mean, you're looking at the flaw. That's not the problem looking at the flaw in dating. The problem looking at the flaw in dating is if you look at it with a superior, you know, oh, she's damaged. How can she possibly fit into my, you know, my perfect presentation over here? That's usually the problem with looking at flaw. If he's a normal guy or she's a normal girl and they're looking at flaw, and they can say, okay, then they have to ask themselves, not is he or isn't he, I'm using he or she interchangeable, not is he or isn't he, but is this, can I live with this? Is this, can I handle this? The vows, at least they take vows in secular marriage, right? The vow is basically, I'm trouble, you're trouble too. You know, I vow that we're just going to chain ourselves together and figure this out. I vow that we don't put, a quick disconnect in that system. Otherwise, we're destined for failure. But flaws, I hope everyone takes note of them and has somebody to process them with, and to see the real question is, you know, can I live with it? Is this something that I know about? Is this something familiar? And is this something that that I'm willing to take, you know, along the way? Yeah, did you have any?
Yeah. I was just wondering, why would the healthy response not be the development of self in response to the problem?
What, in dating?
No, in marriage and dating. Meaning, I'm leaving dating, but really what you were saying about marriage.
Yeah.
When you went to the very deep things in marriage. Yeah. Why isn't it looking at yourself? Like, this is what I have, this is what's in the other.
Yes.
And that means that there's something in me. Like, you've got a grievance, look at yourself as well.
Sure.
I'm not hearing it.
Well, you said it better than I. I think the first lecture, for sure, that was what...
I wasn't.
Yeah. Okay, that's really what it's all about. I think someone over here asked last time, where's it? Is it Midos? Is it her? Back and forth. I said, it's almost always Midos. I said it definitively. Because it's true. So, good. Yeah?
I'm trying to articulate this question properly, but I haven't figured it out. The system that many of the Anglos who are said to live in, where she was placed is here, and if you spoke at the man boy issue, what's been your experience as far as how the yeshivas are getting those boys ready? What should we be tuned in for, what's normal behavior, and what's just a function of the fact that you've been told that even the Torah is the only thing you're involved with in school, like these very lonely sides of the day, what should be expected of them?
Wow. You said you had a problem getting the question out? You had no problem getting it. I'm hesitating because it's such an important question. And as you were asking it, I was going through my mind, I was screening all the different yeshivas and their different approaches. And I was trying to think of, like, is there one yeshiva out there with one mahalach, you know?
Yeshiva's
Anglo Beit Shemesh. Wow, that narrows
it
down.
Their kids, you know? Like, this experiment called RDS. Like,
I think...
like almost everything today, the system is as good as it can be, and if it's not as good as we need it to be, we need to supplement it. Systems teach English, but if we want our children to read on a college level, we have to supplement that. Yeshivas have Musar Vadim, they have Chaburas. Is it enough? No. We all know problems with the system. And one of the biggest problems is so many guys are learning and so many guys are steiging. It's hard to find that personal connection that you need with a mentor, with a senior guy. And so many yeshivas today are implementing the mirror. They have, for every bacher at 18, they have a guy who's married and a younger man, and so many programs. And, you know, the mirror, for instance, is just, so it's an incredible place of chaburas that are flourishing. I work with Bali Tshuva, who have the second year of their program. They have Know Yourself Vod from November till March or April. I mean, no, you know, they have Vadim. Rav Gershenfeld gives Vadim on, you know, how to be a chosin, not just one shmooze, like a whole series of shmooze. So, could that be implemented? Absolutely. You know, I think what's happening in RBS and the Anglo crowd is that we're sort of pushing the envelope towards that. I think we're trying to change it and yet keep mainstream, because you don't want to go too fringe, because that's too fringe, and you don't want to go too you don't want to ignore the need. I think there's a need. I'm involved now with supervising a team of Rebbes in Yerushalayim who want to be able to diagnose more and know more and be able to train more, and it's a very good thing. It's an absolute drop in the bucket in terms of numbers. But last week, you know, I talked about small things change big systems. So that's broken windows theory, you know. So I don't know. That, I think I stated the obvious confrontation with the whole yeshiva system, but quite successfully, if I might add. Yeah. Who else? Yes, sir.
The question that I don't think you can give the answer, but maybe you can just give us one or two thoughts on it. I'm also a therapist, and I appreciated a lot of the ideas and insights that you offered in terms of how to deal with people who have these kinds of issues. But say you're not in therapy, you're a couple, you're struggling with, how do I know the other person? How do I deal with this loss?
Yeah.
How do I understand the ways of seeing me and how interaction?
Yeah.
Is there any kind of that just can help us? Principle that can help us out?
Yeah. The first question I ask with that, with the how question, is do you want to? I'm not being facetious. I mean, it's a very honest question. Do you want to? And before I even ask the question, I ask them for an excruciatingly honest response. Are you interested? If you're not interested, guess what? It doesn't work. If you're going to sit there perfunctorily and say, "Well, you know, tell me about your day," or something like that, and you're really not interested because of one of a hundred sundry things. So the how is informed by, is there a rotzon there? And usually if there's a rotzon there, people are, for the most part, pretty intelligent. You know, if they have a rotzon to do something, if they have a rotzon to get a job, they'll get a job. If they have a rotzon to, you know, find their way in the Tel Aviv to, you know, the embassy, they'll get there if they don't have ways. If they have a rotzon to find something out about their spouse, they'll find out. It's not rocket science. I mean, so I usually start with that, because the how is sort of a red herring, I think. Yeah.
Do
Good. Ellie, any questions? A list of them? Yes, sir.
Would you, this very rule, would you recommend, let's say, should he go to his therapist and get, signed off? Or, in other words,
I hate those.
All the things that you're saying.
Yeah.
Should someone professionally evaluate this? Or just like, the Mashiach said, already said,
You mean to go to be on Shidduchim?
Yeah. Are they ready for Shidduchim? Are they thinking they should work on first? Does everyone have a diagnosis?
Big questions. There's a difference between clinical presentation and sort of a generic. If it's a clinical presentation, they should get an evaluation, either by somebody. If it's not that, and it's just, hey, is my son ready to go out on Shidduchim? Is my daughter ready to go out on Shidduchim? That ready thing is more... is more complicated. What I don't like about going to a therapist is the sort of pressures put on the therapist. Tell us, great, Oseer, great elder of the tribe, tell us, is my son ready? That type of attitude usually doesn't work. It's not yes or no. Is my son ready? Means there's a certain level of accomplishment there. There's a certain madriga that he's on, and it usually, my experience is people don't work that way when it comes to wanting ready to go out. I don't know when somebody's ready to go out, but I could say pretty definitively I know when somebody's not ready to go out. So maybe the answer is sort of a process of elimination the other way. I think the default position is, if a guy, if the Rebbe is saying there's a problem, and the Mashgiach is saying there's a problem, the Rosh Yeshiva is saying the problem, and they go to a therapist, chances are the therapist is not going to say there's no problem here, right? But let's tease this out for a little bit. What's the problem? He learns 20 hours a day. He doesn't have any friends. He davens very long. He wants to learn Yom V'Layla. He has no she'ifas of Parnassa. He is, in one sense, a golden boy. Right? This is what we daven for such a thing, and yet we're scared of such a thing. It's a double-edged sword. So the Mashgiach says, go and get checked out. So what context are we checking him out if he is not a clinical presentation? In terms of the yeshiva world, in terms of the world he comes from, he's it, right? But is he it? Does that sound normal to you? Is it? What's normal? One person, she's very, had a big sense of humor, she would say, Mordechai, all I want in my marriage is normal. I just want normal. I said, there's no normal. She said, standard. All I want in my marriage is standard. I just want standard. Standard, okay.
What does clinical presentation mean?
Do you feel that something's like
wrong
there? Yes. And it's been, and I have this big book about this thick to say, what number he is and what access he is and all that kind of stuff. It's a different type of thing. And a lot of times, did that speak to your question? Or?
Yeah, it does. But let's say a person is picky, like you mentioned before, or it does make a, it's hard for them to commit,
Okay, good. So I'm going to tell you a story. It happened last Wednesday night after I got after we were done here. I came home, and a mashgiach of Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, when I see his name on my phone, I kind of take a deep breath, and then I answer the phone. So he called, Tali, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. He says, I have one for you, and he tells me and he describes to me sort of what the guy I described, but like an order of magnitude beyond this guy. Very, very weak guy, very, very soft presentation, right? And he's married to somebody that the mashgiach said, we've taken her to four different therapists and they all confirm she's bipolar and forget it, there's nothing to talk about. And we want to get a divorce, we want to give her a get right away. What do you think? And the first thing I said was, what, you want to kill him? And he said, what do you mean? And they had somebody on the phone, another mashgiach there. So I said, you're going to take achrayut, you're going to take responsibility for this guy. This guy's, the glue of his life is this dysfunctional relationship. Now you're going to say, be normal, we're going to schlep you out of this environment over here. We're going to schlep you out of the water, we're going to put you on the boat. But his skin is so soft, he's going to get sunburned. He's not going to survive out there like that. So am I saying you should stay in this dysfunctional relationship? I don't know. Maybe I am. But I'm certainly saying it's not a fait accompli that he should get out of that because, I don't like using this terminology, but he's not normal enough to get out of it. If you have to tell him he has to get out of it, there's something wrong with the whole system to begin with. So where do you start? It's a very subjective platform that you have to decide where you're looking at it from and whether you're going to go all the way with him. It's very easy to say he's not normal, but really, I mean, is that the end of the story? It's not. I don't think so. Yes, sir.
People advising someone in the couple, the couple's trouble, advising one of the parties, the couple, that they should get divorced, and taking responsibility for that advice and the consequences of it. How do you deal with that kind of advice? How do you prevent?
I hope they're very close to God, and I hope they secretly have the Urim Bitumim on their chest. I don't know how to respond to that. And this idea of people saying things and taking responsibility for it, how does the third party take responsibility for somebody's divorce? What do they do? Drive them to Beis Din? I mean, what do they do? What does that mean? I don't even know what that means. It's a rhetorical question. There's plenty of answers, but there's no answer. You can't. You can't make them responsible.
Same thing. If I don't do this, because they're not willing to take the consequences of the advice they've given to that party to file a divorce.
Look, therapy isn't advice. I mean, push it. It's not advice. When people say, you know, get out, that creates a very big wave inside a person. And if that wave forms another wave and forms another wave, and then they talk to their best friend whose sister just got divorced and she's happier than a lark, then those waves turn into, you know, to something that creates a tremendous momentum. So you should get divorced. You know, there's a reason why they call it the horrible choice. Let's be a little real here. Why do they call it a horrible choice? It's called a horrible choice. Maybe I call it a horrible choice. Because what is a marriage? A marriage is about giving, right? Two people give to each other. When someone decides to get divorced, they're doing something connected, their mahus. Their mahus is to give. That's why they got involved. Now they're being asked to take for themselves. It's a horrible choice because they don't really know how to be selfish. But they know they have to be selfish. So they're torn between a necessary selfishness and trying to decide whether it's an inevitable selfishness. So what do? The answer is, whatever it is such an ultimately ultra-personal decision. I don't know how anybody gets in the middle of that one. Because the only person who could really take... I'll tell you my mahalo when somebody comes with divorce. I say, you want divorce? Gesundheit, you're going to have to get through me. I'm the keeper of the gate. I don't know where I am in Shemayim, but I have a sword. I'm the keeper of the gate. You want divorce? You're going to have to earn it. You're going to have to earn it so that you have a better divorce than you had the marriage. And you're going to have to come across all the practical and logistic and financial difficulties. You're going to have the answers. Because if you don't have the answers, it's going to be a mess. It's going to be a bigger mess than you have now. And I'm not advocating divorce. I'm not advocating marriage. I'm saying, I'm the keeper of the gate. You got to earn it. You got to, because you don't have to prove it to me. You have to prove it to yourself that you can handle this. Because this is big stuff. This is much bigger stuff than you even signed up for. It's bigger than what you signed up for when you got married. So that's my mahalach. And that's all I have to do. It's enough. And people get to decide through that process. Look, if I was dealing with me, I'd run away from me too. But I don't have any choice. So I gotta, I'm all I got. Yeah. Good?
Great.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, bring all the chairs down, please. It'll be very helpful.